We talk a lot about the Bible on this podcast, but if you're someone who hasn't read the Bible for yourself before, or if you're someone who wants to go deeper, it can be really helpful to have a Bible study guide to follow. Yarrow Bible Studies can help you grow in your relationship with God and find answers to the questions that are on your mind. Yarrow Studies are very visually inviting, and they give you space for reflection at the same time as guiding you through the Bible so you can know what it says and what it means for your actual life. No matter where you're coming from or what season of life you're in, Yarrow is the Bible study guide that will help you unearth the truth of Scripture so it can take root in your heart and inspire you to go deeper in your relationship with God. Yarrow offers beautifully designed inductive Bible studies and a free digital app. If you're looking for a place to start with Yarrow Studies, why not grab a copy of their first study, Known, which is all about identity in Christ. You can shop at yarrow.org now and save 10% off with the code ConfrontingChristianity10. You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church.
I have shown you, Yahweh would say, that they hold no power and there is no truth in them. And so the first commandment sets us up for all of the other commandments by orienting us to what is true, and that is there is only one God.
We're all, I think, ashamed because we realize, anyone who's been angry toward their brother has already committed murder. Like, it's the one person who's seeing into our hearts is also the one who's judging us.
We understand intuitively that good rules are good things. And in the case of God's rules, because Christian understanding would tell us that God is infinitely good, then we understand that his rules are also for our good.
For those who don't know Jen either personally or from her many published works and other resources, Jen is an author and Bible teacher from Dallas, Texas. Her passion is to see others become articulate and committed followers of Christ with a clear understanding of why they believe what they believe, grounded in the Word of God. And to this end, Jen has written multiple excellent books that have helped people do just this, including None Like Him, 10 Ways God is Different from Us and Why That's a Good Thing, In His Image, 10 Ways God Calls Us to Reflect His Character, 10 Words to Live By, Delighting in and Doing what God Commands, Women of the Word, and most recently, You Are a Theologian, An Invitation to Know and Love God Well. I appreciate that there is a theme there, Jen. You're big on the number 10 is what I'm taking away from that.
I'm also a creature of habit. Once I get a working formula, I just go with it. Thankfully, the Bible's big on tens too, so it's been very cooperative.
We are going to get to that big Bible 10 soon. Wait a minute, the big 10, that's some sort of sporting reference, isn't it?
That's an accidental reference for me. I'm not sportsy.
No, nor am I. I just sort of realized I kind of accidentally said something that was sport adjacent. Yeah. Which
I'm proud of both of us for
knowing that. Time. I most recently saw you, Jen, at a Gospel Coalition conference we were both at. Mm-hmm. And we were both on a panel where we were asked a question that I think was meant to be a sort of silly warm-up question, which was, when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up? And I absolutely loved your answer. So I want you to share what your answer was.
I said important. And then I felt like, oh, I don't think that's where we were headed with this.
Well, I loved it because it was funny and profound at the same time.
And revealing.
And revealing, indeed. And I couldn't resist following up by just saying loved. Mm-hmm. Which shows that you and I are very different people. Different needs and insecurities. Tell us, before we get into the meat of the conversation, why did you want to be important? And do you feel like that need is satisfied now that you are a proper adult?
I think my definition of important changed a great deal as I got older. And, you know, I know this is going to sound trite, but each of us is important, full stop. And I think it was growing out of that ambition and pride that is typical of someone who is in their teens and into someone who recognizes that the importance that we operate from has a lot to do with our primary relationships, both vertical and horizontal. So, you know, obviously drawing significance from being an image bearer is different than wanting to self-actualize or self-exalt. But the work that is to be done by an image bearer is deeply important. So,
when you say an image bearer, for those who are less familiar with the Bible than you are, having written multiple books on the Bible, what on earth do you mean by that?
Yeah, just Genesis 1, 26 and 27 tell us that human beings are created to tell something that is true about God in everything that we do and in everything that we think and in everything that we say. In other words, there's something about us that is painting a picture or is a metaphor for who God is. It's a way to understand God. So that's a hefty responsibility and also a great privilege. And so we can either do it well or we can do it terribly. And then based on the presence of sin in the world, which we invited in, we will either choose to give glory to ourselves or give glory to God.
Okay, this is interesting. So when you think about why you are, in the right sense, important today, the first place in the Bible that you go is actually the very beginning.
Right.
It's not... You know, I don't want to kind of prioritize this, but just in our conversation right now, you didn't first go to, I'm important because the Son of God, Jesus Christ, came to die for me. You first went to, I'm important because I'm actually made in the image of God, which is the truth revealed to us on sort of page one of our Bibles as we open it up.
Yes.
And I'd love for us to spend a bit of time today sort of thinking about, and I've explored this with a couple of different guests in different episodes with focus on different Old Testament books, but thinking about the kind of continuity that we see through the Bible from a Christian perspective. And I want to talk about the Ten Commandments, as they are famously called, or Ten Words, as your book describes them. So first, can you give us a sense of where these Ten Commandments fit in the big story of the Bible? And then we'll kind of drill in more to what these Ten Commandments are and how they relate to us now.
Well, the Ten Commandments tell us about the character of God. So in one sense, they are at the very beginning of the Bible, then they go all the way to the very end. But we don't hear them codified or summarized or clarified until Exodus chapter 20. And they're given to the children of God after they are brought out of slavery in Egypt, not during their slavery in Egypt, because as Jesus will say in the New Testament, no one can serve two masters. And so the God of Israel knows that to give his law to children who are enslaved is not going to be something that they can fulfill. And so the law is given when they are actually able to fully obey it as they were created to do. But the law that's given in the Ten Commandments is not a new idea. If you think about all the way back to Genesis, we'll say Genesis 3, but you really could go all the way back before that as well. But in Genesis 3, or actually Genesis 4, the first big sin that we see committed after the fall that happens in the garden with the fruit and the serpent is when Cain murders his brother Abel.
And Cain and Abel being Adam and Eve's
their first two children. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And so in one generation, we've seen it go from, I think I would like to do what I want to do in Genesis chapter 3 to, I think I'm going to take the life of a fellow image bearer in chapter 4. So a very rapid progression of sin, the spread of sin, or the breaking of God's law. So even though we don't receive the sixth commandment not to murder until we get to Exodus chapter 20, no one is reading Genesis chapter 4 and the death of Abel and thinking, well, that law hasn't been given yet, so therefore it's okay, right? Everybody understands what it means to be moral. We understand that intuitively. And I'm talking about whether you're a Christian or whether you're a non-Christian, because since we're made in the image of God, that's in us. Whether we choose to acknowledge it or not, it's something that we have an intuition for. We may push that intuition down, or we may pull that intuition into our forefront of our thinking and being and doing, but it's in there. And so the Ten Commandments, when they're given in Exodus 20, are really just saying, hey, we all know this is true, but let's get this very clear for the children of God, because you as the children of God will be called to look completely different than the people surrounding you, the people in the place that you came from in Egypt, and the people in the place that you're going in Canaan.
Interesting. Okay, I have a confession, Jen. I have taught on the Ten Commandments precisely once in my life that I recall. And it was at kids' church a few years ago. And I came up with a little rhyme to help the kids remember the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to take a risk. For those who do not currently have the Ten Commandments at their fingertips, I'm going to recite this little rhyme and you can laugh at me and tell me that it's terrible. But here we go. Are you ready? Okay. And it comes with like clapping motions. You kind of got to like thump on the table with your hands and clap. And then you go, worship God only, don't make idols, honor God's name, keep the Sabbath holy, honor your parents, don't murder, be faithful, don't steal, don't lie, don't covet. Only Jesus keeps God's law. He's the one our hearts long for. That is nice. All I have to say about the Ten Commandments. So I'm hoping you have...
I was going to beatbox a little and then I thought, maybe not. Oh, she probably doesn't want that. Jen. No. I feel good about my choice not to. Yeah.
Sad. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have these Ten Commandments or words. Mm-hmm. The first one is probably the one that is honestly least intuitive to most humans in culture. Mm-hmm. We may not even think of it as a kind of moral commandment. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the very first commandment, what it is and why it tops the list.
Mm-hmm. So the first command is, you will have no other gods before me. It's not uttered until we have a setup, which is, I am the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. So he basically says, hey, remember me. I'm the one who got you out of the land of worship of idols and false gods. It's me. I'm the one. And so we can't really understand the Ten Commandments if we haven't paid attention to the other set of tens that came before this in the book of Exodus, and that's the 10 plagues.
Interesting. Okay, tell us more about that. So, and break this right down for someone who has never read the book of Exodus in all their life.
But a lot of people have watched that fantastic movie with Charlton Heston, and that's really all you need.
Prince of Egypt.
Well, it's not all you need. Yeah, Prince of Egypt. And so a lot of people are familiar with the 10 plagues that God sends on Egypt, but I think that they're not often viewed for what they were accomplishing. They're seen as like, wow, God got super mad and did a lot of angry things. But each of those plagues is targeting a member of the Egyptian pantheon. Each of them is a statement that God is God, not Ra, the sun god. God is God, not Heket, the goddess of fertility, who is in the image of a frog. So each of the plagues that comes on Egypt is a definitive statement that there is one God, and it is Yahweh. So when we get to the first commandment and he says, you will have no other gods before me, he has just referenced the fact that he has clearly established that there are no other gods. And so what we fail to recognize a lot of times when we talk about the first commandment is that it's nothing less than an invitation into reality. These other things that you have worshiped are actually not real. And in fact, demonstrably, I have shown you, Yahweh would say, that they hold no power and there is no truth in them. And so the first commandment sets us up for all of the other commandments by orienting us to what is true. And that is, there is only one God.
Okay. I love that. So just again, to kind of get us back into the story for those who are completely unfamiliar, God's people are enslaved in Egypt. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. God raises up Moses, who is an Israelite, but who had sort of lived in the palace in Egypt, has been kind of adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. And Moses is one of the sort of more reluctant.
Yes, he is.
People God sends. I mean, Jonah probably even more reluctant than Moses.
Yeah,
but Moses kind of has this reaction to God of like, I think you may have got the wrong person. Like, maybe send somebody else.
Right.
I'm not up to this job.
You're right.
But God sends Moses.
God doesn't disagree with him, just for the record. God says, I'm the one who's going to accomplish this. So get going.
Mm-hmm. So God sends Moses to go and demand of Pharaoh that Pharaoh let God's people go. Mm-hmm. And Pharaoh, they sort of go through the cycle of Pharaoh saying no, and then God through Moses saying, okay, I'm going to send a plague. And and then Pharaoh saying, maybe so. And then you know, we kind of do the cycle again of Pharaoh deciding no. And then finally, God sends this last sort of horrifying plague of the firstborn in every family
yes.
dying except for the Israelites who are protected because they've done what God said and put the blood of a lamb
right.
over their doorpost. So we have this right. sort of Passover as people exit, God's people exit yeah. Egypt.
Yeah.
And then the Ten Commandments sort of come after that, right? When God has taken them to this mountain in the wilderness and
that's
he's
right.
speaking to them.
That's right. And he said all along, he said, the reason I'm doing this is so that everyone will know that I am God. And the everyone is certainly Egypt, but it's also his own children who have been in slavery for 400 years and they have forgotten a lot in that time. And so bringing them out of slavery is a great sign to everyone that God is exactly who he has said he is and he can do what he says he will do. But he says all along, go and tell Pharaoh to let you go that you may worship me on this mountain. And so when they get to the mountain, I think in modern, you know, churchy culture, we would think, oh, if they're going to worship him, it's going to be, as we were joking about before we got on here, it's going to be a TED Talk at a Coldplay concert. You know, it's going to be the typical like praise and worship kind of thing. And instead they get to Sinai and it's God descending in thunder and lightning and giving them the law. Because the law is the means by which he is able to be approached. I would argue, and I would say that we see this played out elsewhere in the scripture or articulated elsewhere in the scripture, that when we obey God, it is worship.
Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, Seminary President Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold. Okay, I love that. Many, I think, who've sort of understood a bit of Christianity, or even maybe those who've been in church for a while, have heard a lot of talk in the New Testament about how we are no longer under the law. So there's sort of understanding of the law given to God's people in the Old Testament for a certain time, and this understanding that actually we by nature cannot fulfill God's
That's
law.
Right.
And so, you know, Jesus comes, he fulfills the law for us, and now we're under grace and not under law.
Yeah.
Given all that is true, why would we read and show any interest in the Ten Commandments now, and how might they apply to us?
Yeah, well, and not only that, but, you know, Christianity has a bad reputation for being only about following the rules. And following the rules is not enough. What Jesus says when he talks about obedience in the Sermon on the Mount in the New Testament, and when he references actually these 10 commandments, he basically says, hey, even if you do the right thing for the wrong reason, you're still sinning. Like you're still not hitting the mark. And he's taking aim at the religious leaders of his day who were very concerned with outward obedience, but not with any inward right motive. And the only form of obedience that is pleasing to God is when right motive is joined with right action. So if there are those listening to the podcast who are maybe not believers, who are not Christians, and they're considering the claims of Christianity, I would just point out that the Ten Commandments, while it's good for people to live moral lives, it's good for all of us. Laws in general are what help us to live at peace with one another. But if you do not have as your reference point worshiping God through your obedience, then even your best day is still not what we would call obedience to God's law. Even when you do the right thing, because you don't have a higher reference point than yourself, then in terms of the ways that Christianity defines obedience, it's still only a partial obedience, and it's one that ends up only bringing glory to you, whether you mean it to or not, simply because you don't have a higher place to point the credit to for having done the right thing. And then for the Christian, you know, we have to remember, all of us have to remember that obedience to God's law is something that is significant to us only after having received Christ into our hearts, only after having been brought into his kingdom. So in the same way that Israel could not obey God's law while still in captivity in Egypt, when we are still in darkness, spiritually speaking, we cannot obey God's law. We can only obey it once we are in the family of God and have the freedom of grace to allow us to do that.
Interesting. Yeah. So I think a lot of people would think of Christianity as a religion where you kind of have to do these various things,
right,
like whether it's go to church or make sure you don't sleep with the wrong person or give to the poor or whatever. And that if you do these things, then you are acceptable to God.
You're earning, right?
But actually it's the reverse of that, that we're not acceptable to God until Jesus, until the Lord opens our eyes to who Jesus is and what he's done for us. Mm-hmm. But then the conclusion of that is not, and then carry on like doing what you want.
That's right.
The conclusion is actually to try to obey. So talk to us more about that.
So, and you know, we understand this in human terms. This is why the Bible so often uses the metaphor of family for us to help to understand these things. God does not want a grudging obedience out of fear. He wants a joyful obedience out of gratitude. Mm. And if you're an earthly parent, or even if you're not a parent yourself, you have been a child to a parent. So think through how this plays out. I have five kids, and I remember when they outgrew just obeying me because they didn't want to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. And they began to anticipate ways that they could serve our family out of a desire to just do something that would be a blessing to all of us, right? Mm-hmm. And I distinctly remember having a dinner one time at my parents' house, and they had invited some friends over, and my kids were all in like late elementary, early middle school. And we all sat, and the kids, you know, took part in the conversation. And then at some point toward the end of the meal, they all stood up, cleared the dishes, went into the kitchen, and just did the dishes. I hadn't threatened them beforehand. I hadn't, you know, Jeff and I are looking at each other like, let's just keep our faces straight and act like this happens all the time, right?
This is normal.
Yeah. But it was a turning point. It was a moment where they wanted to do something. It was a joyful obedience out of gratitude. It was not a grudging obedience out of fear. That's what obedience to God should look like. My children don't need to earn my affection. They just have it, and they can't lose it. They can do stuff wrong. They can make me mad, but I'm not going to unfamily them. And so when we're in God's family, obedience changes from earning to gratitude. And that's what the Ten Commandments should enable us to do. You mentioned earlier that we're not under law, we're under grace. And that is 100% true. But when we're under grace, what happens is the law shifts. It no longer hangs over us, holding us under judgment. It now lies underneath our feet as the path that we walk as those who are wanting to bear God's image as we were created to do all along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've heard you talk really helpfully, Jen, about how we actually recognize the need for rules, for want of a better word, in all kinds of relationships.
Right.
And that it's the rules that we, the sort of healthy rules that we operate on relationally that preserve our relationship. So, you know, you and I as friends, if I respond, you know, if you texted me and said, how are you doing today? And I sort of sent back a bunch of expletives, that would be, you know, an inappropriate thing to do to a friend. And it's not even that we've sort of we have codified that as a rule, but that actually it would be meaningfully violating friendship to just like send you back a bunch of curse words when you'd like kindly ask me how my day was. And a trivial example, but you know, whether it's in marriage or parenting or friendship or kind of colleagues relationships, we may not think of them like that, but we actually do have a set of rules that protect the relationships that we're in. Is that fair to say?
That's the whole purpose of rules. Like if you live alone on a desert island, you don't need a speed limit.
Right.
You know, the speed limit is there not just so that I can thrive myself. It's there so that we can all live in safe ways with one another and in ways that honor one another. And so that's one of the functions of any law. Laws help us to live at peace with each other. Mm. They do more than that. But and then if you think about the big story of the Bible, it's a story of God bringing order out of chaos, the whole thing. And so like even in the 10 plagues, why they're so shocking is because they are actually the reverse of that. In order to show judgment, he reverses the order and he brings chaos out of order. And so when he brings his children out of slavery and to the foot of Mount Sinai, they are a disordered people in a lot of ways. They have lived in a disordered kingdom in the terms of its loves and its worshiping and all of those things. And so now what he is going to do is he's going to bring order out of chaos among his own children by giving them these good rules. One of the ways I'll sometimes talk about this is to say, if you were on Monday morning, your local elementary school called you and asked you to substitute in a first grade class, and you have to do it, but you have a choice between a classroom where the teacher just wants to hug the children and love them and they call her by her first name, or a classroom where the teacher has some basic rules posted up on the board. Things like, let's keep our hands to ourselves. You know, we use our indoor voices, all those kinds of things. You know which classroom you're want to go into. And so we understand intuitively that rules are actually good things. Good rules are good things. And in the case of God's rules, because Christian understanding would tell us that God is infinitely good, then we understand that his rules are also for our good.
This is the second time you've maybe wanted to tell a story about my five-year-old who last week, I'm not going to resist the urge this time. So last week I picked him up from the bus coming back from school and I said, how was your day? And he said, Mom, I had a frantically bad day. And I said, tell me why. He said, what does frantically mean? I said, well, it kind of means wildly. He said, Mom, I had a wildly bad day. I said, okay, darling, tell me more what happened. And he said, Benjamin told me to throw a ball at Aiden's face and I did. And I was like, okay, that's a pretty bad day. But he said,
bad day for Aiden for sure.
But it was Benjamin's fault because he told me to do it. Mm-hmm. I said, no, it actually was your fault because you did it. And he said, it was Aiden's fault because he threw leaves he threw the ball back at us because we did that. I was like, no, still your fault for throwing the ball at Benjamin's face. I don't think his class has a rule that says don't throw the ball at other people's face. Mm-hmm. But clearly he was violating a sort of principle of kindness. And I think as we scroll through the Ten Commandments, my guess is that some of them will strike us as pretty intuitive. So, you know, don't murder. You brought that up already, Cain murdering Abel. We kind of know, like, whatever our background or beliefs, we know that murder is wrong.
Off the table, right?
Don't steal, like similarly, don't lie. I think probably we at least think, yeah, in principle, but there might be some exceptions to that where we'd feel better about, you know, lying than telling the full truth in a situation. Mm-hmm. When it comes to not coveting, as in not sort of desiring or in an unhealthy way, sort of desiring our neighbor's wife or ox or various, you know, in the original context, sort of various things that somebody else might have. That really doesn't, I think, strike most of us today as intuitive. So help us think through the pieces of the Ten Commandments that actually don't kind of make sense to us at a basic intuitive sense.
Well, there's a little bit of a progression to the way that the Ten Commandments are given. So, you know, you've got the first four kind of through five. So those are all focused on authority. So they're focused on God and then on our parents. So they're basically saying you need to honor God and then you need to honor your parents, those who are human authorities. And parents is actually an expansive idea. It doesn't just mean your mom and dad. It means anybody, as the Puritans would say, anyone who is our superior in age or experience.
Tell me, sorry, pause on that for a second, Jen, because I've heard that before, but I've never done the homework to actually see that properly justified versus it being honor your parents only and specifically.
Well, one
that's
of the places,
a rabbit trail, but
yeah, one of the no, I love this rabbit trail. I've thought about writing a whole book on this. One of the ways that we know that it's expansive is because in the New Testament, when Jesus' mother and brothers come to him and want to have a word with him while he's teaching, he says, "Who are my mother and brothers and sisters?" And he looks around the room that he's teaching and he points to his disciples and he says, "Anyone who does the will of the Father is my mother and my brothers and my sisters." And then also in Paul's epistles, he talks talks about how he tells Timothy that he is to regard older women as mothers and older men as fathers and younger women as sisters and younger men as brothers. So when we begin to think about the church as the family of God, that's one sort of concentric circle for this. But you could even argue that it goes beyond that because we also have words in the New Testament about honoring government officials. So I do think that there is a general principle. And that's actually the key to thinking about the Ten Commandments. Human nature is to say, what is the bare minimum that I need to do to check this one off, right? So if I can just limit it to my earthly parents, then I could probably do a decent job unless I have terrible earthly parents. And then it's going to be harder to show honor to them. And many of us do, frankly. But then also think about the sin of murder. And this is what Jesus does in the Sermon on the Mount is we go, oh, I haven't murdered anybody. So I got one right. And then we move on to the next one. Adultery. Oh, okay. Well, I haven't slept with anybody who I'm not married to. So this week or whatever. So I'm good on that one. And then he gets to the later ones, don't steal. And we're like, well, I haven't robbed a bank. You know, do I sit on social media at work all day long and steal time from my employer? Well, you know, now we're splitting hairs. And so when we think about what God is requiring of us in his moral law, we should think in terms of an expansive obedience. How many ways might I look to apply this? Not what's the least amount I can do to check off a box. That's the legalist. That's the self-promoter. And it's an idea that I'm really not that bad. And even though we are under grace and the law does not mean that we earn God's favor, the law does give us a measure of whether we're growing in holiness, whether we look more like Christ today than we did yesterday, because Christ obeyed the law perfectly. Therefore, the more we obey it, the more we're going to look like him.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, and famously, Jesus, in his Sermon on the Mount, sort of took two of those commandments, don't murder and don't commit adultery, and said, you know, you've heard that it was said, do not commit adultery, but I say to you, anyone who's looked at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery in his heart. So suddenly we're all, I think, ashamed because we realize, anyone who's been angry toward their brother has already committed murder. Like the one person who's seeing into our hearts is also the one who's judging us.
That's right. And he doesn't mean to equate, being angry with murder. He's not saying that at all. He's using hyperbole. But what is he saying? He's saying, where do you think murder starts? Like murder always starts with anger. It starts with us being mad that what we wanted didn't happen and what someone else wanted did. And so that's when I talk about a progression that happens in the way that that the Ten Commandments are laid out. Murder is rooted in contempt, which is the child of anger. But also adultery is rooted in contempt. You don't cheat on a spouse that you hold in high regard. You've already thought contemptuous thoughts. It was probably started in anger. So when we're aware of where things begin, we're more likely to be able to deal with the root issue. Anger is a negative emotion, but it's not a sin until it becomes a sin. In its initial stages, it's simply a recognition that my will has been violated and I don't like it. Now we hang on to it and it very quickly moves to self-justifying and to, you know, we start to spiral and then it turns into contempt, which is the difference between simply saying I'm mad at you and saying you are worthless. That's contempt.
Yeah.
And so it's those two ideas that are often behind the sins, are always behind the sins of murder. If someone's worthless, you're more willing to take their life. Or adultery, if someone is worthless, you're more likely to consume someone as an object of desire. Adultery is not like a romance gone bad. It's consumption of another human being. That's what's in view. And then when we think about theft, well, it's easier to take something from someone who you have no regard for. You think about bearing false witness. It's easier to lie about someone who you have contempt for. And then when we get to that last one, you shall not covet. Basically what he's done is he said, hey, don't do it. Like don't murder someone. Don't commit it. Don't let your actions do something that they shouldn't. And then with the sin of bearing false witness, he said, don't say it. And then when we get to covetousness, he said, don't even think it. It moves from the external to the internal. So none of us gets a miss on these. It's going to hit every single one of us, even if we don't own an ox, as the covetousness one references so helpfully.
Wish I had an ox.
Every day I think that.
Well, you do live in Texas. So, you know, I'm sure oxes abound. last question for you, Jen. So I have a dear friend I mentioned on this podcast in the past who also listens to this podcast. So hi, dear friend, who was raised Jewish, has been exploring Christianity for a while, and is sort of feeling caught, honestly, between Judaism and Christianity in the sense of feeling a deep belief that there is a God who made the universe, and that at least some of what the Bible says about God is profoundly true. But she's sort of really essentially struggling to make up her mind between sort of sticking with Judaism and jumping over to Christianity. She's a little bit sort of caught in no man's land right now. What would be your best, I hate to use the expression elevator pitch, because it's it's so much less, that just sort of demeans the whole process. So I shouldn't even have used that term. But imagine you had just like 2 minutes to explain to somebody why beautiful and compelling as God's revelation in the Hebrew scriptures is, why actually Christianity, or could say messianic understanding of the Old Testament with Jesus at the center, is more compelling and beautiful and believable.
I mean, I think that everything in the Jewish books of the Bible is calling that there's more. And then when we get to the story of Jesus, even the way that actually, I would urge your Jewish friend, if she has not already, to just dip her toe into the Gospels, because so Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Matthew in particular is very concerned with saying this is how Genesis and Exodus were showing us that Jesus was coming, and that we needed that sacrifice. We needed a sacrifice to end all sacrifices, and that every sacrifice that had ever been made in the Old Testament was intended to show us that there was no amount of blood of animals and bulls that could atone for our inability to fulfill the law ourselves. And I think just the metaphor of freedom that we see in the story of the Exodus, that because when we find Christians hear that Christ fulfilled the law, well, then we understand that it's his work that means that we stand not at the foot of a mountain that is thundering in fear that we should feel, that would make us think he's going to kill us, which is what Israel said. Instead, we come to a better mountain. We come to the heavenly mountain, Mount Zion. So, you know, if you love the Jewish scriptures, I think you'd love the New Testament, because everybody who wrote a book in the New Testament loved the Jewish scriptures. And they may be loving them from a slightly different perspective, but I think it's a compelling perspective. So I would say, go there. Look for your own the words that you love in the words of those authors, and see how they are connecting dots to the sacrifice that we couldn't provide on our own.
Love it. Thank you so much, Jen. Always a delight to chat with you and to learn from you about many things, not least the Ten Commandments.
Rebecca, you are loved.
Thank you, Jen. You're actually not that important. But I love you, which is more important than that. You've been listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram, or you can leave a review on iTunes. Please join me next week when I'll be interviewing a history professor friend about how she became a Christian just last year after becoming convinced that Jesus really did rise from the dead. Until then.